Republic. Rafi for intimates. As he contemplated the splendor and uncommon elegance of his new son's name, Signor Pico peeled off his cap and tunic, which formed a pile of khaki on the floor where he dropped them. Juana walked over to collect them. This was precisely why we had followed him here, to perform the incidental tasks, so he wouldn't have to think about them at the peak of his joy. I glanced over at Juana's man, Luis, who stood alone in the doorway, looking as though he were going to cry. Luis was still dressed in his daily gardening clothes, a mud-streaked shirt, and a roomy pair of pants hanging like an opened parasol around his narrow frame. He held a straw hat reverently against his chest. His face showed the ache of wanting that I had seen in Juana's eyes earlier. Because of his shyness, Luis hid all emotion behind his careful gestures of courtesy and respect. He did not venture past the threshold into the bedroom to see the babies. No one asked him to, either.
"Wouldn't you like your supper, senor?"
Juana asked, gathering our patron's tall laced black boots from the floor. Señor Pico motioned her away with a wave of his happy hands.
"Should we draw you a bath?"
she persisted.
"Leave the water on the coals for me," he said.
Luis ran off to warm Señor Pico's bathwater.
"It must have been painful. Was it painful?"
Señor Pico asked his wife. She smiled with a peaceful glow on her face. Juana placed Señor Pico's clothes in the armoire.
"Amabel, Juana, you may both leave us now,"
Señor Pico said. While the señor visited with his wife and children, I watched from a rocking chair outside the door to my room as Luis sat in the yard with a hurricane lamp, using his hat to fan the fire under Señor Pico's bathwater. As the flames grew, the night breeze teased them, forming dancing shadows on the sides of the tin bucket. Juana walked over to her man and handed him a bowl of stew. Luis placed the bowl of stew near the bucket to warm. He cleared a spot on the ground and spread a rag next to him for Juana to sit on. She told Luis of having had word and dried coffee grains sent from her sisters. Juana spoke excitedly about Señora Valencia's babies, how she could not believe that Señora Valencia, a child whose birth she had witnessed, was now a mother herself. As she chattered, Luis looked at the dark around him, seeming afraid of being attacked by the trees. Yet he remained silent, waiting for his turn to speak. Finally, Juana fell silent too.
"Señor Pico bought a goat that I must cut up and salt tonight," was what he said first.
"Where's the goat?"
she asked. Juana peered at the goat, hanging by its hind legs from one of the strongest branches of the flame tree. She then examined her man's face, perhaps sensing that something disagreeable had taken place, something he was not telling yet.
"How was the journey?" she asked.
"Too fast," reported Luis. "Don Ignacio went too fast going to the barracks. Señor Pico went too fast coming back. I thought you'd have to go and plant a white cross on the side of a mountain for me. They say those automobiles are made for automobile races. I felt like we were in one."
"Are you still shaking?"
Juana asked, wrapping her large arms around his meager frame.
"I haven't told you even half detail," Luis said. "Señor Pico was the one driving on the return. I have never seen a man so overjoyed. It wasn't his fault. Who can blame him?"
"Blame him for what?" Juana asked.
"Señor Pico was driving and talking. The closer we came to the house, the faster he went. He asked Don Ignacio all sorts of questions about the children. When Don Ignacio wouldn't tell him for the 77th time how big the children were, who they looked like, and so much else, Señor Pico went even faster. When we reached the road near the ravines, we saw three men walking ahead. Blessed Mother who gives life, forgive us,
Juana interrupted. She raised both her hands up in the air as though to complain to the stars.
Señor Pico shouted at the men and blew the klaxon,
Luis continued.
Two of the men ran off. The other one didn't seem to hear the horn. The automobile struck him, and he went flying into the ravine. He yelled when the automobile hit him, but when we came out to look, he was gone. It was a bracero. Maybe one who works at Don Carlos's mill.
I knew most of the people who worked with Sebastian at Don Carlos's mill lived in Don Carlos's compounds and toiled in Don Carlos's cane fields. The valley was small enough that most of us were familiar with one another. I thought immediately of Sebastian. Surely another worker would have come for me already had Sebastian been struck by Señor Pico's automobile. Something rustled under the flame tree. We all jumped to our feet. I expected to see Sebastian running towards me, his body drenched in blood. Instead, it was Dr. Javier and his younger sister Beatrice. Beatrice spent her days pounding her fingers on a piano in her mother's parlor and speaking Latin to herself. She wanted to be a newspaper woman, it was said, travel the world, wear trousers, and ask questions of people suffering through calamities greater than hers. Señor Pico had been courting Beatrice, who had no interest in him, before he began pursuing the señora. One day, when Beatrice had abruptly asked him to leave her mother's parlor so she could play her piano alone, the señor had stumbled down the road in a haze of lovesick rejection and seen Señora Valencia, who was plucking red orchids from her father's garden to put in a small vase at her bedside. Señor Pico, known to her only as Beatrice's frequent escort at local society gatherings, suddenly joined in the orchid picking, and after a month of visits to the señora's parlor, asked Papi for her hand in marriage. Papi said yes after consulting with the señora, on the condition that his daughter would stay in her own comfortable house, rather than having to live in one of those meager isolated bungalows near the barracks, where Señor Pico often needed to be located due to his special military duties. Juana rose to greet the doctor and Beatrice. Beatrice had braided some bright ribbons into her caramel-colored calf-length hair. The braid swayed back and forth like a giant fish skeleton across her back. Nodding to Juana, Dr. Javier asked,
"Has the father arrived?"
"Yes, he has come," Juana said. "Good evening, Señorita Beatrice."
"Salve," replied Beatrice in Latin.
"Hola to you too, Señorita Beatrice," Juana said, dusting off the back of her dress. "Will you please go into the house?"
I didn't stop worrying about Sebastian. As the laughter and Beatrice's effortless Latin phrases echoed from Señora Valencia's bedroom, I walked over to the flame tree and peeked at the dead goat Señor Pico had brought home. Near the bloody spot where the goat's nose almost touched the ground lay my sewing basket and Sebastian's still unfinished shirt. I had dropped them there when I'd heard Señora Valencia's first screams. I picked up the basket and Sebastian's shirt and took them back to the rocker with me. The joyful reunion continued upstairs while Luis kept fanning the flames to keep Señor Pico's bath warm. Soon after, Dr. Javier watched me from afar as he left with Beatrice. Señor Pico was ready for his bath. Luis carried the water to him.
"My wife wishes to see you,"
Señor Pico shouted at me from across the yard. I went to her room. She was lying in bed, alone for a brief moment, her children sleeping nearby.
"I am grateful to you, Amabel, for what you did today."
She reached over and squeezed my hands. When her husband entered the room in his sleeping robe, she quickly dropped my fingers.
"Juana will stay here tonight," she announced.
"Why Juana? Why not me?" I thought. But maybe Juana had asked to stay. Perhaps she needed to cradle a cloud-soft child and pretend that it was hers. Besides, I had to go to my room and wait for Sebastian. Surely he would know what had happened, who had been struck by the automobile. Juana was in the old sewing room of Senora Valencia's mother, piling blankets on the floor to sleep on. Behind her stood a four-poster canopy bed that Papi had built long ago for his wife's afternoon siestas. Senor Pico pulled shut his wife's bedroom door to keep out the night air. I waved goodnight to Juana, who was already dozing off. Juana blew out her lamp, leaving me in the dark. In their room, Senor Pico tried to make his wife laugh by telling her how much he had missed her all those nights when he'd been sleeping on stiff, narrow, insect-filled mattresses in the barracks.
"Is it so terrible?" she asked.
"Yes, it was," he said. "Even worse than that, if truth be told." Away from her, everything was like a seat on a metal bench in hell. The senora asked her husband if he had to return to the barracks soon. The soldiers in his charge could wait a while, couldn't they? He'd try to stay through her lying-in period, he said, but things could change quickly. Had he forgotten to inform her? Where had his memory gone? The generalissimo was spending some time with friends not far from here. The generalissimo's good friend, Doña Isabella Maya, was planning to throw a lavish ball for him near the border. He, her husband, could she fathom it, had been given the task of heading a group that would ensure the generalissimo's safety at the border. They would also be in charge of a new border operation. Wouldn't this take him away for even longer periods of time? Senora Valencia wanted to know. She was not to worry at all, he assured her. The operation would be quick and precise. To tell the truth, part of it had already started. She didn't sound as happy as perhaps he had wanted her to be.
"Let's not speak of you leaving again," she said. "At least you are with us now."
In the parlor, Papi sat alone, as he did every night in a corner near the parlor's accordion-shaped radio, straining to make out an announcer's voice without disturbing the others. He was an exiled patriot, Papi, fighting a year-and-a-half-old civil war in Spain by means of the radio. On his lap were maps showing different Spanish cities that he consulted with a hand magnifier as he listened. The maps were cracked along the creases and edges, becoming closer to dust with every passing day. "How is the fighting today?" I asked. "Is your side winning?"
"The good side does not always win," he said. "Do you wish you were there? In the war? An old man like me?"
Above Papi's head loomed a large portrait of the Generalissimo, which Senora Valencia had painted at her husband's request. Her painting was a vast improvement on many of the Generalissimo's public photographs. She had made him a giant in full military regalia, with vast fringed epaulets and clusters of medals aligned in neat rows under the saffron braiding across his chest. Behind him was the country's red and blue flag, with the white cross in the middle, along with the coat of arms and the shield. Dios, Patria, Libertad. God, Country, Liberty. But the centerpiece was the Generalissimo himself, the stately expression on his oval face, his head of thick black hair, the beginning of gray streaks carefully omitted, his full vibrant locks swept back in gentle waves to frame the wide forehead, his coy gentle smile, and his eyes, which seemed oddly tender. Bedroom eyes, Minnie had called them. Papi seemed unaware of the Generalissimo's enormous presence as he listened for word from much farther away.
"Would you like some hot guanabana tea?" I asked. "Good for sleep."
He shook his head no.
Amabel, I am not a lucky man, he declared.
Why do you say that? I asked.
I think we killed a man tonight, he said.
Then it seemed to me that the dead man was even less lucky than he.
On the day my grandchildren are born, I was in an automobile that may have taken a man's life, Puppy said. My son-in-law did not want to stay and search, and I did not force him to do it. It was already dark. I didn't make myself or Luis go down into the ravine to look for the man, to see if we could save his life. You will tell me, Amabel, if you hear of this man, if you hear that he lived or died. You will ask your friends, and then report to me.
I will.
Good night, then.
Good sleep, Puppy. Outside, Luis skinned and chopped up the dead goat. He piled the legs in a bucket and covered them with clumps of rock salt. When I was a child, my father and I used to play a game called Osle, using the small front leg joint bones from a goat. These bones are like dominoes, except they have a curved back and three hollowed sides. I'd spend hours alone trying to get a handful of five to land on the same side. I never succeeded. I asked Luis to cut off the two small bones for me. Wiping off the blood, I took them to my room. There I undressed, taking off my sand-colored house dress and a matching faded square of cloth wrapped around my head. Nearly everything I had was something Señor Valencia had once owned and no longer wanted. Everything except Sebastian. I spread an old sheet on the floor next to a castor oil lamp and a conch shell that Sebastian had given me, saying that in there flowed the sound fishes hear when they swim deep inside the ocean's caves. On the wall was pasted a 7-year-old calendar from the year of the great hurricane that had plundered the whole island, a time when so many houses were flattened and so many people were killed that the Generalissimo himself had marched through the windswept streets of the Dominican capital and ordered that the corpses he encountered during his inspection be brought to the Plaza Colombina and torched in public bonfires that burned for days, filling the air with so much ash that everyone walked with their eyes streaming, their handkerchiefs pressed against their noses, and their parasols held close to their heads. I lay on my mat on the floor, giving Sebastian time to arrive. If he didn't come soon, then I would have to go and look for him in the compound at the meal. In the meantime, I did something I always did at times when I couldn't bring myself to go out and discover an unpleasant truth. When you have so few remembrances, you cling to them tightly and repeat them over and over in your mind so time will not erase them. I closed my eyes and imagined the giant citadel that loomed over my parents' house in Haiti, the fortress rising out of the mitre-shaped mountain chain like two joint fists battling the sky. The citadel had been conceived by Henri the First, a king who wanted to conquer a world that had once conquered him. My father loved to recount this tale of Henri the First, a slave who, after the captives had rebelled against the French and formed their own nation, built forts like the great citadel to keep intruders away. As a child, I played in the deserted war rooms of Henri the First's citadel. I peered at the rest of the world from behind its columns and archways, and the towers that were meant to hold cannons for repelling the attack of ships at sea. From the safety of these rooms, I saw the entire northern cape, the yellow-green mountains, the rice valley, the king's palace of 365 doors down in the hills above Milo, and the Palais de Ramire, the queen's court across the meadow. I smelled the musty cannonballs and felt Henri I's royal armor bleeding rust onto my hands.
armor emblazoned with the image of a phoenix rising over a wall of flames, and the words the king was said to have uttered often, Zurne de Mesondre, promising that one day he would rise again from the ashes of his death. I heard the wind tossing through the wild weeds and grass growing out the cracks in the stone walls. And from the high vaulted ceilings, I could almost hear the king giving orders to tired ghosts who had to remind him that it was a different time, a different century, and that we had become a different people. Imperceptibly, Henri de First's murmurs became Sebastian's. I rose and walked to the door. Sebastian was standing there. He handed me two yams with the roots and dirt still clinging to them. The yams were from the small garden behind his room at the compound. Sometimes I cooked for him. Whenever we could, we ate together. I almost dreamt about you, I said. I was home, and I wanted you to be with me. I've been waiting outside, watching for the right moment, he said. His shirt, one of the many I had made for him from indigo-dyed flower sacks, was covered with dried red mud and tufts of green grass. There were cactus needles still sticking to the cloth, and some to the skin along his arm, but he did not seem to feel their sting. One of his eyes was swollen, the pouch underneath visibly filled with blackened blood. He tried to smile, holding the side of his face where the smile tore at him in hurt. Did you fall in the cane fields? I asked, already sensing it was not so. I touched the scruffy beard that he had grown the last few days. Some clumps of the hair were stained green, as though his face had been pressed down against crushed grass for a long time. I cannot stay, he said. At least he was speaking normally, I thought. His voice had not changed. Old Congo's waiting for me at the meal. His son, Joel, was killed. Joel is dead. His dirt-stained forehead was sweating. He brushed the sweat off with a single swipe of his hand. Joel dead? How? Eve, Joel, and me. We were walking along when an automobile hit Joel and sent him into the ravine. And you? Did you break any bones? I asked, as if this were the only way in which a person could be wounded, only when his body was almost crushed, pulped like the cane in the presses at the mill. Eve and I were lucky, he said. And then I thought how truly fortunate he was. He was not crying, or yelling or throwing rocks at the house, or pounding a tree stump against the side of the automobile that had killed his friend. Perhaps the truth had not yet touched him deeply enough. But then, he had seen death closely before. What's Congo doing? I asked. Perhaps Sebastian was staying calm by thinking of the next step, the next action. The first thing is to put Joel's body in the ground, he said. Does Congo know whose automobile hit Joel? At this time, all he knows is that his son is dead. He needs to make a coffin. Don Carlos won't pay for a burial. Luis and Papi had gone to bed. I led Sebastian behind the latrines. There, Papi had a stack of cedar planks that he used for his leisure occupation, making tables and chairs and building miniature houses. Sebastian took four long boards, stained and polished, enough to build a coffin for a grown man. I offered to help him carry them, but he refused. You stay, he said. I will come back. I looked down at the yams, leaning against the wall where I had laid them soon after he had given them to me. With all this, you had time to bring these yams? I asked. You stay here until I come back, he said. Don't try to go anywhere. I heard him breathing hard, struggling with the weight of the wood as he hauled it away. I went back to my room, lay down, and waited for his return. Poor Kango. Condolences, Kongo. Two new children came into the world, while you have to put your son in the ground. 9. It is a Friday, market day. My mother, my father, and me, we cross into Dajabon, the first Dominican town across the river. My mother wants to buy cooking pots, made by an Haitian pot maker named Moy who lives there, the best pot maker in the area. There's a gleam to Moy's pots that makes you think you are getting a gem. They never darken, even after they have been used on outdoor cooking fires for years. In the afternoon, as we set out to wade across the river again with our two new shiny pots, it starts to rain in the mountains, far upstream. The air is heavy and moist. A wide rainbow arc creeps away from the sky, dark rain clouds moving in to take its place. We are at a distance from the bridge. My father wants us to hurry home. There's still time to cross safely, he says, if we hasten. My mother tells him to wait and see, to watch the current for a while. We have no time to waste, my father insists. I'll carry you across, and then I'll come back for Amabel and the pots, my father says. We walk down from the levee. My father looks for the shallows, where the round-edged, rust-colored boulders we'd used before as stepping stones have already disappeared beneath the current. Hold the pots, my mother tells me. Papa will come back for you soon. On the levee are a few river rats, young boys, both Haitian and Dominican, who for food or one or two coins will carry people and their merchandise across the river on their backs. The current is swelling, the pools enlarging. Even the river rats are afraid to cross. My father reaches into the current and sprinkles his face with the water, as if to salute the spirit of the river and request her permission to enter. My mother crosses herself three times and looks up at the sky before she climbs on my father's back. The water reaches up to Papa's waist as soon as he steps in. Once he is in the river, he flinches, realizing that he has made a grave mistake. My mother turns back to look for me, throwing my father off balance. A flow of mud fills the shallows. My father thrusts his hands in front of him, trying to keep on course. My mother tightens her grip around his neck. Her body covers him and weighs him down at the same time. When he tries to push her up by her legs, a cluster of vines whisks past him. My mother reaches for the vines as though they were planks off a raft. As the rain falls, the river springs upwards like an ocean riptide. Moving as close as they can to the river's edge, the boys throw a thick sisal rope to my parents. The current swallows the rope. The boys reel it back in and wrap it around a boulder. The knot slides away from the boulder as soon as it leaves their hands. The water rises above my father's head. My mother releases his neck, the current carrying her beyond his reach. Separated, they are less of an obstacle for the cresting river. I scream until I can taste blood in my throat, until I can no longer hear my own voice. Yet I still hold Moy's gleaming pots in my hands. I walk down to the sands to throw the pots into the water, and then myself. The current reaches up and licks my feet. I toss the pots in and watch them bob along the swell of the water, disappearing into the braided line that is the river at a distance. Two of the river boys grab me and drag me by my armpits away from the river. Their faces seem blurred and far away through the falling rain. They pin me down to the ground until I become still. "Unless you want to die," one of them says, "you will never see those people again." 10. When Sebastian returned from the compound that night, he was wearing a clean shirt and had washed most of the grass from his face. He sat and leaned back against the wall, watching a lizard dash across the ceiling. I made room for him to lie down on the mat next to me. "Señor Pico's at home now," I said. "You have to be careful coming and going."
"At this moment, what I want more than anything is for Señor Pico to try and strike me," he said, in an angry tone that I was not used to. Perhaps it was all becoming more familiar to him now. His friend had died. He could have died. We were in the house of the man who had done it. Sebastian could go in and kill him if he really wanted to. "Señor Pico has rifles," I reminded him, "and we are on his property."
"Is the air we breathe his property?" he asked.
"How was Congo?"
"No one can find him," he said.
"Where did he go?"
"After we brought the body to him."
"What condition was the body in?" I asked,
regretting the words as soon as they left my mouth.
"He fell from a great height into the ravine," he said.
"What did Congo do with the body?"
"He let a few people see," he said calmly. "Then Eve and I helped him take Joel down to the stream. We washed him and cleaned off all the blood and brought him back to Congo's room. Congo said he wanted to stay alone with the body. Then while I was waiting here to enter your room, he took it away."
It was hard to imagine Congo hauling Joel very far on his back. Joel was much taller and larger boned, the kind of man who was called upon to pull an ox cart full of cane when the oxen were too fatigued to do the job.
"They say a son's never too big to be carried or beaten by his father," Sebastian said, rubbing a bald fist against his swollen eye. "If Congo carried off Joel by himself, then there's more truth to that than I thought."
"Maybe Congo wished to say his farewell alone," I said, raising his fist from his eye.
"The others have been out looking for him," he said. "I think he took Joel's body away because he wants us to let him be. I'm going to respect his wishes. He'll come back when he wants."
He ran both his hands up and down my back. He had been this way the whole year we'd been together. His favorite way of forgetting something sad was to grab and hold onto somebody even sadder.
"You're sweating," he said, letting his fingers slide along my spine.
"I had my dream of my parents in the river," I said.
"I don't want you to have this dream again," he said.
"I always see it precisely the way it took place.
We'll have to change this thing, starting now."
He blew out the lamp. The room was pitch black. I squeezed my eyes shut and listened for his voice.
"I don't want you to dream of that river again," he said.
"Give yourself a pleasant dream. Remember not only the end, but the middle and the beginning, the things they did when they were breathing. Let us say that the river was still that day."
"And my parents?" "They died natural deaths many years later."
"And why did I come here?"
"Even though you were a girl when you left, and I was already a man when I arrived, and our families did not know each other, you came here to meet me."
His back and shoulders became firm and rigid as he was concocting a new life for me.
"Yes," I said, going along. "I did wander here simply to meet you."
"I don't give you much," he said, "but I want you to know that tomorrow begins my last safra. Next year, I work away from the cane fields in coffee, rice, tobacco, corn, an onion farm, even yucca grating. Anything but the cane.
I have friends looking about for me. I swear it to you, Amabel, this will be my last cane harvest, just as it was Joel's. I knew he considered Joel lucky to no longer be part of the cane life.
Trava de puso,
the farming of bones. Tonight, when Eve and me, we carry Joel's corpse into the compound, he said. I thought about how both Eve's father and my father died. His father organizing brigades to fight the Yankee occupation in Haiti, and my father in the hurricane. I reached up and pressed my hands against his lips. We had made a pact to change our unhappy tales into happy ones, but he could not help himself. Sometimes the people in the fields, when they're tired and angry, they say we're an orphaned people, he said. They say we are the burnt crud at the bottom of the pot. They say some people don't belong anywhere, and that's us. I say we are a group of voyageurs, wayfarers. This is why you had to travel this far to meet me, because that is what we are.
11. I am sick in bed with a fever that makes my body feel heavier than a steel drum filled with boiling tar. I sense myself getting larger and larger, and at the same time more liquid, like all the teas and syrups my mother pours into me. My father says that I am in fact becoming smaller, shrinking closer to my bones, and there is little that is liquid in me that the fever does not dry up. It is a sickness we brought home to her from someone else, my mother concludes, while standing over me one day, her lips puckered, her mouth switching from side to side, as it always did when she was in deep thought. I suppose it might be the young girl we treated 2 weeks ago, you remember? My mother makes me a doll out of all my favorite things. Strings of red satin ribbon sewn together into the skin. 2 pieces of corn cob for the legs, a dried mango seed for the body frame, white chicken feathers for flesh, pieces of charcoal for the eyes, and cocoa brown embroidering thread for the hair. There are times when I want to be a girl again, to touch this doll, because when I touch it, I feel nearer to my mother than when her flesh is stroking mine in the wash basin or in the stream. Or even when she's reaching down to plop down a compress heavy with aloe on my forehead. As I lie in bed with my doll and my fever, during the few moments when I'm alone, the doll rises on her corncob feet, yanks several strands of her thread hairs and uses them to jump rope. She sings my favorite rope jumping songs, plays with my osles, and says, "You will be well again, ma belle, ma belle. I know this to be true." Her voice is gentle, musical, but it echoes, like she's speaking from inside a very tall bottle. "I am sure you will live to be 100 years old, having come so close to death while young." While I am watching her play, I want to give the doll a name, but I don't remember names other than my own. And that one only because I've just heard her say it while addressing me. When I am well, like the doll said I would be, I ask my mother, "What name should I give to this doll who walked about the room and played for me and looked after me when I was sick?" "There is no such thing and no such doll," my mother says. "The fever made you an imbecile." 12. The sweet, fleeting smell of lemongrass at dawn has always been my favorite scent. Standing at the top of the hill, I saw Luis in front of his house, using a flour sack rag to wash Joel's blood off one of the 2 automobiles owned by Señor Pico. Packets, they called them. The type of vehicle the Generalissimo himself loved to be driven in at that time. I walked to the stream behind the neighboring sugar mill, where the cane workers bathed at daybreak,
before heading out to the fields. It was the first day of a new cane harvest. The stream was already crowded, overflowing with men and women separated by a thin veil of trees. Everyone was unusually quiet, even in their whisperings. Instead of the regular loud morning chatter, there was only the sound of hummingbirds chirping, the water gurgling, circling around all the bodies crammed into its path. I waved to Mimi, Sebastian's younger sister. She slid her face in and out of the water, making bubbles with her mouth. Mimi had followed Sebastian to the valley when he'd moved here. These days, she worked as one of the maids of Doña Eva, the widowed mother of Dr. Javier and Beatrice.
This afternoon, Doña Eva is having a mass in Sancocho for the anniversary of her birth, Mimi announced. My feet floated above the warm pebbles at the bottom of the stream. It was as if nothing else of much importance had taken place, and for want of other information, she had announcements from her mistress's life to share. The Doña is 50 years old. Will your people be coming to her mass?
Mimi always called Señor Valencia and Señor Pico Munuyo, my people, as though they worked for me. While pedaling in the stream, she ceremoniously raised her arms above the surface of the water and picked a small leaf off my nose. On her right hand, she had a bracelet made of coffee beans, painted in yellow gold and threaded on a string. Just like Sebastian's. It was something their mother had made them for safety and luck before they left on the other side of the border after the hurricane had killed their father. Thinking of the 50th anniversary of Doña Eva's birth being on the first day since Joel's death, and that perhaps I would never have a chance to utter a farewell to Joel's closed eyes, I murmured to Mimi, "Do you think you and I will live long enough to be as old as Doña Eva?"
"I don't want to live so long,"
she answered in her usual abrupt manner.
"I'd rather die young like Joel did."
"Do you really want to end like that, in a ravine?" I whispered to her, so the others would not hear.
"I'd rather have death surprise me,"
she said loudly.
"I don't want to wait a long time for it to come find me."
Mimi was at least 4 years younger than me, and, not counting this sudden death she was saying she wanted, had more time ahead of her than I did. There were women in the stream who were ancient enough to be our great-grandmothers. Four of them were nearby, helping a few of the orphaned girls to wash themselves. Among the oldest women, one was missing an ear. Two had lost fingers. One had her right cheekbone cracked in half, the result of a runaway machete in the fields. The oldest cane-cutting women were now too sick, too weak, or too crippled to either cook or clean in a big house, work the harvest in the cane fields, or return to their old homes in Haiti. So they started off every morning bathing in the stream, and then spent the rest of the day digging for wild roots, or waiting on the kindness of their good neighbors. Mimi's face grew sad and serious as she observed the other women, especially Felice, a young woman, the housemaid of Don Gilbert and Doña Sabine, a rich Haitian couple who lived among the valley's well-to-do families. Felice had a hairy beet-colored birthmark like a mustache over her lip. She was reasonably pretty, but the birthmark was all you saw when you looked at her face. Felice had been Joel's woman for some time. Congo, Joel's father, had disapproved of the whole affair because he knew firsthand some of Felice's family history. In a moment of desperate hunger, during the first years of the Yankee occupation, Felice's grandfather had stolen an old hen from the yard of Congo's mother in Haiti. He couldn't bear having his son take up with a woman whose family had a thief for an ancestor, Congo had said. There was always a risk that this type of thing could run in the blood, he
He didn't want to take any chances with his only heir. Now Kongo was bathing in the middle of the stream, scrubbing his body with a handful of wet parsley, while the sun climbed up in the sky above his silver-tipped hair. We used pesi, perejil, parsley, the damp summer morningness of it, the mingled sprigs, bristly and coarse, gentle and docile all at once, tasteless and bitter when chewed, a sweetened wind inside the mouth, the leaves a different taste and the stalk. All this we savored for our food, our teas, our baths, to cleanse our insides as well as our outsides of old aches and griefs, to shed a passing year's dust as a new one dawned, to wash a new infant's hair for the first time and, along with boiled orange leaves, a corpse's remains one final time. The other men stood apart, giving Kongo more space than usual. He moved slowly as he scrubbed his wide shoulders and contorted himself to allow the parsley to brush over the map of scars on his muscular back, all the while staring at the water's surface, as though he could see more than his reflection there. Sebastian and his friend Eve were standing closest to Kongo, nudging away those who wanted to pay their respects.
"I keep asking myself what Kongo's done with Joel's corpse," Mimi muttered in my ear, leaning forward. No one would dare dispute Kongo, no matter what he had done with his son's body. He was the most respected elder among us. We all trusted him. Kongo dropped the parsley in the stream and raised his machete from the water. Holding his work tool up to the sun, he stroked the edge of the blade as though it were made of flesh. Kongo was still an active worker. He had toiled side by side with his son for more than a dozen cane harvests. Before the full harvest, during the dead season, Kongo, Joel, Sebastian, and his friend Eve had cleared tobacco fields together. On Sundays, they cut down trees to make charcoal to sell. "If one of our men had killed Kongo's son, they'd expect to die," Mimi said. "But since it is one of them, there's nothing we can do. Poor Kongo, this must be killing him inside. I say, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth." A few more people arrived. They shed their clothes and squeezed into the spaces left in the water. Void of ceremony, this was a silent farewell to Joel, a quiet wake at dawn. "Your people killed Joel running home to their twin babies, didn't they?" Mimi asked. "I hear this is how it happened." "Yes, that's how it was. Beatrice thinks you'll be the godmother of one of the twins. The senor and the senora will decide. What Beatrice wants, she is often given." "Do you always call her Beatrice?" I asked. "I don't have to christen her senorita in your presence, do I?" I thought of Senora Valencia, whom I had known since she was 11 years old. I had called her senorita as she grew from a child into a young woman. When she married the year before, I called her senora. She, on the other hand, had always called me Amabel. "I don't call her Beatrice in her presence," Mimi explained. "But what would be so terrible if we did say only their Christian names?" "It would demonstrate a lack of respect," I said, "the way you'd never call one of these old women by their names. You call them Mon, even though they're not your mother." Mimi flinched and looked down at her coffee bean bracelet. She seemed pained for a moment as she glanced at the old women, perhaps searching for her mother's smile beneath their scowls. "What does it matter if Beatrice and your lady become angry with us?" she said. "If they let us go, at least we'd have a few days of freedom before dying from hunger." "There is your brother who counts on you," I said.
wanting to halt this needless quarrel in light of the heavier pains in the air. Even when he's buried in debt, he can always secure a meal from you, or from you, she insisted. But you are his blood, I said. With myself, if we quarrel, he won't eat from me. I thank you for reminding me why I'm so bound to the misery of that woman's house, she said. When you and my brother set up house together, then perhaps I will be free. Everyone watched Kongo as he emerged from the stream. He walked off, leaning on a broken broom handle that served him as a cane. Sebastian and his friend Eve, who had also been on the road when Joel was killed, followed behind Kongo, ready to catch him if the broom handle failed. Eve had a shaved head that shimmered as bright as Kongo's machete under the morning sun. He and Sebastian followed Kongo back to the compound. When will you and Sebastian start living in the same house together? Mimi asked. If my brother is too timid to ask, I can act as a go-between. Yesterday, Juana called me a non-believer because I don't normally pray to the saints, I said. She asked me if I believed in anything, and all I could think to say was, Sebastian. I'll have to tell Sebastian. Mimi splashed the water with her palms. The others turned to stare, cutting their eyes at her for seeming too joyful on such a day. She paddled the water with more force, making it rise up and shield her like a curtain of glass. She was like a naked statue in one of those fountains at the town square with water sprouting out of her navel and mouth. No sad faces, she said. Joel's well enough where he is. He'd want us to be glad for him. We should give him a joyous wake to send his spirit on its way. He would want us to laugh and be grateful he's not here now. Felice walked out of the stream and went to dress in the bushes. Mimi was one of the last people still left in the water. Mimi's only a child, I said, following Felice. She didn't know what she was saying. This must be what it means to get old, Felice said, in her usual urgent voice, which sometimes blurred the words when she was speaking. She covered the hairy birthmark with her hands as she chose her words and forced them out. I could hate no one when I was young. Now I can, and I do. Dropping her head onto my shoulder, she pressed her forearms into my ribs as she leaned against me. Her body felt heavy and limp. I was afraid she was going to faint and fall right there at my feet. Courage, dear one, I said, trying to hold her up. He was too young, she said, and Kongo will not even let the others act in response to this. What can be done? An eye for an eye, as Mimi says. No eye for no eye, I said. We cannot start a war here. It would not be a war, she said, only something to teach them that our lives are precious too. What will this do for Joel now? Everything's lost to Joel, she said. It's too late for him, but we should do something to keep them from taking others. She pulled herself away from me to stand on her own feet. We must leave it to Kongo, I said. It is his son who died. He will know best what to do.
13. Every night, Sebastian talks in his sleep. Do you know what I would like to do? He asks one night. Tell me what you would like to do. You feel masterful making a sleeping person respond while you, awake, question the person. In some ways, it is a miracle, like being loved or watching a parrot, such a small animal, repeat words that have just crossed human lips. I'd like to fly a kite, Sebastian answers in his sleep when I ask what he would like to do. What manner of kite? a piece of clear paper over a bamboo spine, a girl's red satin ribbon for the tail. If I offer you my red satin ribbon? He turns over and buries his head in the pillow. If I offer him my red satin ribbon? No retort.
14. Between the stream and Don Carlos's meal were the houses of those Sebastian called the non-voyager Haitians, the ones who were better off than the cane cutters, but not as wealthy as Don Gilbert and Doña Sabine and their friends, the rich Haitians. The stable non-voyager Haitians lived in houses made of wood or cement. They had colorful galleries, zinc roofs, spacious gardens, cactus fences with green vines crawling between the cactus stems. Their yards were full of fruit trees, mangoes and avocados especially, for shade, nourishment, and decoration. They were people whose families had been in Alegria for generations, landowners, farmers, metal workers, stonemasons, dressmakers, shoemakers, a married school-teaching couple, and one Haitian priest, Father Woman. Some of them had Dominican spouses. Many had been in Alegria. We regarded them all as people who had their destinies in hand. That morning, I thought of Sebastian's decision to leave the cane fields after the harvest, as I greeted those of them who were already outside, some sitting in cane-backed chairs while they had their morning meal of bread and coffee, corn mush and mango, others marching around their property like sentinels before rushing out to their day's work. I saw Inel, a dwarfish stonemason, and called out to him. He waved back with a wide, toothy smile. Inel had once built the workers' latrines in Señor Valencia's yard, along with a group of friends he called his brigade. Parents were walking their children to the one-room school started by Father Woman and a Dominican priest, Father Vargas. The flat cinder block building was already too crowded, and the parents who were taking their young ones there complained, as they did every morning, about the limitations on their children's education. "I pushed my son out of my body here in this country," one woman said, in a mix of Alegrian Creole and Spanish, the tangled language of those who always stuttered as they spoke, caught as they were on the narrow bridge between two nearly native tongues. "My mother too pushed me out of her body here. Not me, not my son. Not one of us has ever seen the other side of the border. Still, they won't put our birth papers in our palms, so my son can have knowledge placed into his head by a proper educator in a proper school. To them, we are always foreigners, even if our grandmamme were born in this country." A man responded in Creole, which we most often spoke instead of Spanish among ourselves. "This makes it easier for them to push us out when they want to." "You heard the rumors?" another woman asked, her perfect Creole embellished by elaborate gestures of her long fingers. "They say anyone not in one of those Yankee cane mills will be sent back to Haiti." "How can the Yankee cane mills save anyone?" the Dominican-born woman with the Dominican-born son replied. "Me, I have no paper in my palms to say where I belong. My son, this one who was born here in this land, has no papers in his palms to say where he belongs. Those who work in the cane mills, the mill owners keep their papers, so they have this as a rope around their necks. Papers are everything. You have no papers in your hands, they do with you what they want." I thought of my own situation. I had no papers to show that I belonged either here or in Haiti where I was born. The children who were being taken to school looked troubled as they glanced up at their parents' faces, which must have seemed, if I remembered the way a parent's face looked to a child, only a few inches away from the bright indigo sky. I found it sad to hear the non-voyager Aesians who appeared as settled in the area as the tamarind trees, the birds of paradise, and the sugarcane. It worried me that they too were unsure of their place in the valley. After joining the group, the stonemason Inel began to talk about Joel.
Did you hear that he attacked an innocent man with an automobile and threw his corpse into a ravine?
Inel asked. This is not the way it was, I wanted to say. But who was I to defend Signor Pico? Many of them had heard about Joel, but this was not anything new to them. They were always hearing about rifles being purposely or accidentally fired by angry field guards at braceros, or about machetes being slung at cane workers' necks in a fight over pesos at the cane press. Things like this happened all the time to the cane workers. They were the most unprotected of our kind.
First it is someone like Joel, and then it will be someone like us,
Inel said, showing a braver sentiment than the others,
unless we gather together to protect ourselves.
Don Gilbert and Doña Sabine had erected a circular wall along the road, enclosing them inside their expansive villa. As we moved towards their gate, I saw Felice standing on one of the raised verandas between the two arched stone staircases at the front of Doña Sabine's house. Doña Sabine stood in front of her, gesturing in our direction. The people ahead of me all spun around to look at Doña Sabine. Each adult in turn pointed at his or her chest, asking with hand signals whom she wanted. Doña Sabine kept pointing until Inel realized that she was calling to him. Inel broke away from the group and moved towards the tall wrought iron gate to Doña Sabine's house. Her 10 Dominican guards stood in a crowd at the gate, ready to defend her in case Inel proved dangerous. She waved them off and motioned to Inel to follow her and Felice past the foliage in her garden. The flowering bushes lined up in cropped rows, like schoolboys' new haircuts. Felice looked up and gave me a quick shy smile as I walked past the gate, then returned her gaze to the amber-tinted mosaic designs on the path as she walked at Doña Sabine's side. Doña Sabine had once been a famous dancer who had traveled everywhere in the world. Her husband owned a rum enterprise, which had been in his family for 5 generations, first on Aesian soil, and then on what became Dominican soil during the two governments' land exchanges some years before. Doña Sabine herself was a short woman, thinner than was perhaps beneficial to her health. From behind, she looked more girlish than most girls, but each of her steps was like a long, practiced dance. Now her elegant feet were engulfed in large cowhide slippers that probably belonged to her husband. Her hands were weighted down by a ring on every finger except the thumbs. It was as though she were wearing all the jewels she owned, guarding them on her person rather than sheltering them in a cache. Inel followed her and Felice up the covered passageway to the main house. She likely had some work for him to do. Doña Sabine's husband, Don Gilbert, was standing out in the sun in a beige nightshirt, shouting orders to a large group of people who were scattered about the garden. When he looked up to see Inel, his wife blew him a silent kiss, which he returned with a wave of his hand. In spite of their smiles and kisses, there was a feeling of distress about the place. It was as though another Yankee invasion was coming. I had never seen so many people working for Don Gilbert and Doña Sabine. Clusters of anxious faces peering out from everywhere in the garden, people who looked tired and ill, some with bandages on their shoulders and pieces of clothing acting as slings to hold up their arms. On the way back to Señora Valencia's house, I stopped at the parish school to visit with Father Roman.